Star Wars, Star Trek, and lots of sci-fi are part of mainstream American culture. That's in part because of pulp magazines like Astounding, which launched the careers of writers like Isaac Asimov.
The idea that science fiction is about cultural change, about different scenarios, about what could happen to our society in the future, that's central to what science fiction became in the mainstream.
Chicago area writer Alec Nevelet Lee joins us to talk about his new book, Astounding. Plus,
too much glee leaves rings around the brain. Take that joy and send it down the drain. Some people like...
That's from the latest Mary Poppins movie, which comes out soon. There are lots of movies out this holiday season. We'll dive into some of the best ones with movie critic Reggie Ponder. All that and more coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. The latest news is next.
Down and bent in half, they brush right off and start to laugh. Can you imagine that?
Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up today, it's our last live show of the year. We will be speaking with Chicago area writer Alec Nevelet Lee about his new book, which delves into the history of science fiction. And you're going to get to hear from some of the folks behind the scenes here at the 21st. I am turning the microphone over to our 21st producers so you can hear from them. Of course, the holidays are filled with lots of traditions, festive food, decorations, getting together with family, and perhaps escaping all of this and heading to the movies. This is the time of the year when you can count on some big releases, lots of choices, whether you're looking for something for the kids or some art independent films. Reggie Ponder, otherwise known as The Real Critic, that's R-E-E-L, is back with us from our studios in Evanston at the Medill School of Journalism to help us make better movie choices over the holidays. Hey, Reggie, great to have you back on the 21st. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays, and I am glad to be here.
Now, I don't know if you have a Christmas Day tradition of going to the movies. I know lots of families do. Parts of my family do. What about you?
Yeah, our family does the same. But I've noticed, however, for many families, it has changed a little bit. Is that what used to happen in my family is that everybody would go to the same movie. Now with these multiplex theaters, what happens is that we all go to the movies, but then we split off. So the kids might go to one movie and the adults will go to another movie. And it's not as fun because
it used
to
just
be...
Yeah, that's not the holiday
spirit.
So. All right, so do we have an Incredibles 2 that is a good compromise for everybody that's coming out this year?
Yeah, yes you do. It's Mary Poppins. So when we talk about Mary Poppins, I think that that's going to satisfy young and old alike.
Actually, we have a clip from Mary Poppins. Let's hear it.
Too much glee leaves rings around the brain. Take that joy and send it down the drain. Some people like to laugh at life and giggle through the day. They think the world's a brand new shiny toy. And if while dreaming in the clouds they fall and go kersplat, although they're down and bent in half, they brush right off and start to laugh. Can you imagine that?
That's Emily Blunt singing a song from the new Mary Poppins. I don't know if this is a sequel, if this is a reboot. What are we calling this, Reggie?
This is a sequel. It's called Mary Poppins Returns, and Emily Blunt plays Mary Poppins. I just want to tell you, this movie is fantastic. I found myself using words that I normally don't even use.
Like stupendous?
Stupendous and delightful. And I don't even use those words.
So, Reggie, are you sitting down?
Yes.
I never have seen Mary Poppins, the original.
Oh, huh?
I know. My Robin Lynn, our producer, and now the control room, everyone's dying as I'm saying this.
Oh, my goodness. I'm so glad you told me to sit down because this is a shock. So it's a good thing that you actually said that. Let me just say a few things.
I'm just admitting it. It's the first step.
Thank you. It is the first step. So there are jokes in this film that you would not get if you have not seen the original. It doesn't mean that you have to see the original, but I'm recommending for people before they go, sit down with their kids, family, and actually watch this movie. It's a great tribute to the original. Emily Blunt is fantastic. Lin-Manuel Miranda is outstanding. I mean, the cast is great. The music is contagious. You just heard part of it. The visuals are transporting, and the message is an evergreen message. There's a song in there about the book judging a book by its cover. There's another one about looking at things differently. They just do this so well. It is so good.
Wow. Well, that is a ringing endorsement. I don't know if we're going to hear that from any of the other movies that we're talking about. So let's talk about a blockbuster action movie. And I wanted to ask you about Bumblebee, which is the latest in the Transformers series, which is not always a favorite of critics, but this is a franchise that keeps going and going. You just saw Bumblebee, right, Reggie?
I just saw it last night. So this is fresh off the dome, if you will. I didn't love Bumblebee. I didn't hate it, but
do you love the franchise?
Bits and pieces of it. So there would be one or two of the movies that I just felt were fantastic, and then other ones were like, oh, okay, they were okay. This one I felt it was okay. It looks good on the screen. The Transformers are fantastic. The kids who like Transformers will like this. I mean, the Autobots. I mean, there's so much fighting in this one that if you're looking for that type of thing, you're gonna like it. I just didn't feel totally connected to the story. I think that they probably took it maybe a little bit more tongue-in-cheek than they probably should have. A lot of times we say, don't take yourself too seriously. I would have liked them to play this a little bit more straight as opposed to some of the stuff that was in the film. So it was okay. This is a matinee movie at best for me. So if you go on, you know, the Christmas holiday, make sure you just get the lowest price possible.
Reggie Ponder is the Real Critic. He's a member of the African American Film Critics Association, is the resident film critic for Vocalo 90.7 FM in Chicago, and we're talking to him about holiday movies. Let's stick with one more action family, and that's the animated Spider-Man movie that's out. And before we talk about it, Reggie, let's hear a little clip from it.
Oh, yeah, I got one of these, too. There's a little shed where I keep my spider gear.
Was yours anything like this?
Mine was like this, but take away the Jeep, the plane. Imagine it way smaller. Imagine a futon.
That's the new Spider-Man movie that's also one of the holiday blockbuster releases. Reggie, what are you thinking about this one?
So you know that I like the Marvel Universe. We've talked about this before. I'm already predisposed to liking this film. We have multiple Spider-Men from multiple universes fighting the almighty Kingpin, Doc Ock, the whole crew. I don't need to get into the plot, because when you start talking about this plot stuff, they will tell you about the Spidey origin over and over and over again. But if you're looking for Spidey humor, you're going to have it. If you're looking for the police hate Spidey because he's a vigilante, you'll have it. If you're looking for good fighting, it's in there. But what makes this one outstanding is that this is an animation masterpiece. The visual presentation is so good, it looks so fun, and it really invites you into the Spider-Verse. I actually want to sing it for you for a minute, like Spider-Man, I'm sorry, I'm getting carried away. Anyway, this is a different Marvel offering that will satisfy that superhero craving while addressing superhero fatigue. And what I mean is that everybody's like, we have too many superhero movies. This is so different that you're going
to
love it.
Okay, so let's go to the complete opposite end of the spectrum then. Oscar nominations are coming out in January. This is the time of year that we've got a lot of award contenders. And one that's getting a lot of attention, I loved the interview Regina King did on Weekend All Things Considered, and that's If Beale Street Could Talk, and that opens on Christmas Day. Let's listen to a clip first, Reggie, and then you can tell us a little bit about it.
That child is coming. It's your grandchild. I don't understand you. It's your grandchild. What difference does it make how he gets here? The child ain't got nothing to do with that. Ain't none of us got nothing to do with that.
So this is Barry Jenkins, If Beale Street Could Talk. That's Regina King. Reggie, what can you tell us about this? Really?
So this is a James Baldwin adaptation. And James Baldwin is very adept at showing the human condition as well as highlighting the injustices of our system, especially as it relates to people of color. And this is a story that is wrapped in love. It's all about this love relationship between these two young people. But what happens to the male character, Zoe, when he's falsely accused of raping a woman? what happens in the movie is that their lives are just turned totally upside down, the impact on their families. But the thing that holds it together so much is this love that you see. A lot of times when we look at movies with African-American characters, we don't get to see love. We might get to see sex, but we don't get to see a loving, nurturing relationship. And this love is throughout this film. The storytelling in this is captivating. The visual presentation is mesmerizing. And the love is aspirational in this one. This is probably my favorite movie of the year. I'm giving it 4 reels.
There's another indie release that's getting a lot of Golden Globe nominations for the lead actresses. It's called The Favorite. Before you tell us about it, let's listen to a clip of that.
I'm ready for the Russian ambassador.
Who did your makeup?
We went for something dramatic. Do you like it?
You look like a badger. Oh. Are you going to cry? Really? Well, what do you think you look like?
Badger.
Do you really think you can meet the Russian delegation looking like that?
No.
I will manage it. Go back to your rooms.
Thank you.
That's Olivia Colman as Queen Anne with Rachel Weisz in The Favorite. Reggie, I have to tell you, I saw Mary, Queen of Scots this weekend, and these 30 seconds sounded so much better than anything of that I watched.
Olivia Colman is so good here. Rachel Weisz and Emma Stone are good as well. And for people who don't know the story, what it is that Queen Anne has the throne, but she has these two of people who are close to her who are trying to vie for her affections and her influence. And one is Rachel Weisz and the other is Emma Stone. And I'm talking about the battle here is absolutely fierce. There's some underhanded stuff. This is a really nice period piece, and The Favorite is aptly named because I think it's going to be the favorite for some of these awards coming down the line.
Let me ask you about one more film that's getting award buzz. That's Vice. Directed by Adam McKay, who did Anchorman and The Big Short. Christian Bale plays Dick Cheney. Should we spend the holidays with Dick Cheney, Reggie?
If you want to know how to get power, then you want to see this movie. Because this shows how Cheney was probably one of the most powerful men in Washington. And he did some things behind the scenes that, you know, maybe Mike Pence might want to do as well, because this was some shrewd stuff. If you like politics and good acting, Christian Bale is really good in this one. He transformed himself. So, yeah, this is definitely worth watching.
As we wrap up talking about some holiday movies, big releases and small with Reggie Ponder, the Real Critic. Reggie, maybe you want to stay inside. You do not want to go to the movies. Can I put you on the spot to name your all-time favorite holiday movie?
You can absolutely do that. My all-time favorite is It's a Wonderful Life. I watch it every year, and I think that the message is so poignant. It's a message about every life is important. Every life is important. If you weren't here, there are things in that life that just would not have happened. And I love Jimmy Stewart in it. I cry watching that movie every year, so I love it.
It's this business of nickels and dimes and spending all your life trying to figure out how to save 3 cents in a length of pipe. I go crazy. I want to do something big and something important.
You know, George, I feel that in a small way we're doing something important. It's satisfying a fundamental urge. It's deep in the race for a man to want his own roof and walls and fireplace. And we're helping him get those things in our shabby little office.
Well, that is definitely a classic. What about Beyond the Usual Suspects? If we want to surprise the family with a Christmas title and say this is a Real Critic approved film?
So a lot of people don't think that Die Hard is a Christmas movie, but it is. Die Hard would be a really good one to watch, and I can give you very quickly a couple of things to just convince you that it's a Christmas movie.
Well, before you do that, let's play a little bit of it, and then you can add on.
All right.
Get them back. Not mine.
Now I have a machine gun.
Ho, ho, ho.
Okay, that's our Christmas moment we picked from Die Hard. Reggie, what else makes this an ultimate Christmas movie.
So firstly, he's trying to make it home for Christmas Eve. So you know that. Secondly, there's this greedy, grinchy villain. The dialogue is full of these ironic Christmas references. There's McClane's wife's name is what? Wait for it. Holly. And then the music. I mean, they play a lot of different songs as it relates to this. This is a Christmas music, a movie, and it actually does snow at the end. You'll know what I mean if you watch the movie again. So this will be a fun movie to watch. Yeah, he uses a couple of words that might not be appropriate, but you can hold the kids' ears for that one.
Well, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year. Thank you for taking us on a holiday movie tour. That's Reggie Ponder, the Real Critic, R-E-E-L. He's the resident film critic for Vocalo 90.7 FM in Chicago. Reggie, thanks for being with me.
Thank you for having me. Happy holidays.
Support for the 21st comes from Sock Club, delivering new designs of socks each month made with cotton grown and knit in the southeastern United States. Gift subscriptions are available this holiday season to keep friends and family in socks year-round. More information is available online at sockclub.com.
Tuning into the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Science fiction is everywhere in 2018, not just in the form of our favorite books, TVs, or movies, but even in the actual technology we use in our daily lives. But the story of sci-fi goes back decades, long before films like Star Wars or 2001: A Space Odyssey. The 1930s and 40s are known as the golden age of science fiction. This era and the people in it is the subject of Chicago area writer Alec Nevila Lee's latest book. It's called Astounding: John W. Campbell, Isaac Asimov, Robert A. Heinlein, L. Ron Hubbard, and the Golden Age of Science Fiction. And what tied all of these men together is the sci-fi magazine called Astounding, which in many ways helped create the genre. Alec Nevila Lee joins me now from our studios at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism in Evanston. Hi, Alec. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. I'm very glad to be here.
So I think in many ways, this is kind of the backstory to the current sci-fi age that we are in. But it's also what created many of the things that we take for granted in kind of our mainstream American life right now. And I'm thinking about things like Star Wars or Star Trek. How did Astounding pave the way for what we enjoy now?
In some ways, I wrote this book out of my own curiosity about how modern science fiction emerged. And as you said, you know, it's such a big part of mainstream culture these days that it's very easy for us to take it for granted. But if you look at how it actually evolved, you know, you see that it kind of comes into being at this very specific point in the late 30s and early 40s in the pages of pulp magazines. This was a self-contained subculture that had very passionate fans, but it was not something that a lot of readers were aware of. And it was small enough that a small number of writers and editors could have a really outsized influence. So one of my goals was to kind of look at their lives and their careers and kind of see how their opinions and their interests and, you know, sort of the very messy aspects of their biographies affected what we know as science fiction today.
Alec, I think it's such an interesting thing. I really enjoy reading science fiction, and I probably watch a lot more science fiction than I read. But I had never heard of these pulp magazines. But there are a lot of people, and I'm thinking about how these pulp magazines continue to inspire real life innovators. Is there sort of like a underground cult following of these magazines still to this day?
Absolutely, for the magazines, and even more so for the authors they publish for the first time. You know, people like Isaac Asimov, Robert Heinlein. You know, if you look at someone like Elon Musk, who in some ways embodies, you know, some of the best and the worst aspects of that kind of culture. He talks about reading Asimov growing up. He put a digital copy of Asimov's Foundation trilogy into space earlier this year on one of his Falcon Heavy rockets. And again, it's very symbolic because a lot of people that went on to have great careers in the sciences and in STEM fields, they were inspired to become scientists and engineers by the science fiction they read growing up. This is especially true of older readers. I found that this book tends to appeal to, at least, you know, at this stage, to readers of a certain age. And I will say it does make a great holiday gift for your parents if, you know, they grew up reading science fiction. So I'll just throw that out there. But, you know, it also affects the media and the stories that science fiction fans of all backgrounds are reading. You know, this is kind of like where the rules were set down. And you can really see the influence of, you know, this one magazine, Astounding, in almost every kind of science fiction that you see today.
And like Elon Musk, these men have very complicated histories. There's a lot to be told about them, both positive and negative. And I wanted to ask you first just about the magazine itself. John W. Campbell Jr. becomes known as its most famous editor. How did these pulp magazines first get established?
So the first science fiction pulp magazine was actually called Amazing Stories, and it was founded by an immigrant named Hugo Gernsback from Luxembourg in the late 20s. And, you know, those first magazines, they weren't that great. You know, the stories at least were kind of forgettable, at least by today's standards, and very few of those works have survived, you know, as far as like still attracting new readers. But they, you know, definitely inspired a passionate fan base, especially among younger writers or younger fans. And about 10 years later, those fans who kind of grew up with the pulps are old enough to start writing stories for themselves. And that's kind of the second wave of science fiction, where you don't just have professional pulp writers, you know, who might have made their mark in like other genres like westerns or adventure fiction or nautical fiction. You have people who have been reading this stuff since they were 12 years old. And obviously they're going to care about the genre and they're going to care about science fiction on a deeper level. And so Campbell, who was born in 1910 and became the editor of Astounding in 1937, was basically in the right place at the right time to take advantage of that generation of writers. And, you know, it was a very small market at that point. You know, there were only a handful of really established magazines in the field. And Astounding, you know, when Campbell took over, was already the most prestigious, you know, well-regarded magazine in the field. And so if you were an ambitious writer, if you cared about science fiction, you know, Campbell was really your only market. So he was able to exert a disproportionate amount of influence on science fiction and kind of what it became. And so Campbell had certain ideas about what science fiction should be and what were the appropriate or, you know, the most promising avenues of exploration for science fiction. And so his tastes and his you know, in some ways his prejudices really shaped the genre for decades to come.
And so I think it's kind of crazy to read about Isaac Asimov, who started, as you mentioned, as one of these fans, and how many of his early works were rejected by Campbell. Is it something like 8 or 9 times before he had a submission that was accepted by Campbell?
Yes. So Asimov is a really interesting case because he was a fan first. This is a young man who was born in 1920 in Russia, and he's an immigrant. He comes over, and you know, when he's very young, you know, when he's 12 years old, he starts to read these magazines. And, you know, all he wants to do is write science fiction. And so, you know, when he's about 18 years old, he writes his first story and sends that to Campbell, who rejects it. But the great thing is that these two start to meet on a monthly basis. You know, Asimov lives nearby. And so he takes the train into Manhattan once a month, and Campbell kind of sees him as a protege. And, you know, he does break in eventually. He's very young. He's 19 years old when he publishes his first story in Astounding. And Campbell sees him as this almost like an experimental subject where, you know, he's clearly talented, clearly eager, clearly full of potential, and very willing to take instruction, very willing to use Campbell's ideas. And so for the next few years, you have this, you know, really interesting dynamic where Campbell will come up with an idea for a story, for example, the Three Laws of Robotics, which are, you know, a very famous contribution of science fiction to mainstream and to scientific culture. Things like those laws, they came from Campbell. You know, Campbell had lots of ideas, and, you know, he was a great writer in his own right, but he was even more eager to be an editor because it meant that he had hundreds of writers working for him to realize his ideas and their stories. And so someone like Asimov, who's, you know, more than happy to use those ideas, becomes the greatest possible instrument for Campbell to express those notions.
When you say he had a specific philosophy, I wonder how you think that was, how he thought science fiction should be written.
Well, so Campbell is a very interesting figure because, you know, on the one hand, he's associated with kind of the progression of science fiction in terms of the quality of the writing, the characters, and in particular of the science. So, you know, Campbell was, you know, he went to MIT and Duke University, where he studied physics, so he had the background to make sure the stories were scientifically accurate. And so, yeah, for the first time, he was very anxious to have stories where the science actually made sense. So that was part of it. But the other really interesting thing about Campbell is that he's one of the first editors to say basically that science fiction isn't just about technology or about space travel. It's about cultural change. Campbell is really interested in psychology and sociology, and he thinks that these are fields that are not quite exact sciences yet, but they could be. And so there's a huge thread in the science fiction of this period where psychology and sociology are kind of raised to the level of engineering. And so, you know, you see this in Asimov's Foundation series, which is a very famous example of a story where the lead character basically turns history into an exact science. You can predict the future for, you know, up to hundreds of years in the future. Based on, you know, principles that you extract from your observations of human behavior. And this is a theme that Campbell thought was fascinating. In some ways, the idea that science fiction is about cultural change, about different scenarios, about what could happen, you know, to our society in the future, you know, that's central to what science fiction became in the mainstream. I think people respond to that, you know, on a much deeper level than they do to the technological side. And Campbell was kind of the first person to say, you know, we're not just, you know, here to entertain readers. We're here to generate scenarios for what could happen to, you know, our culture. And I think that's a huge part of what science fiction became.
And it really opens a door in so many ways for so many writers as we're thinking about that legacy. My guest is Alec Nevala Lee. He's the author of Astounding, John W. Campbell, Isaac Asimov, Robert Heinlein, L. Ron Hubbard, and the Golden Age of Science Fiction. Alec, I think one of the more fascinating parts of this book is to think about how nerd culture is kind of also pretty mainstream in the U.S. these days. And I'm thinking about how many people go to things like Comic-Con. What was it like in the beginning for science fiction fans and events and gatherings they had, like Worldcon, which really I imagine you think are the precursors to what these huge mass gatherings that we see today?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question because on the one hand, so fan culture in the period that we're talking about here, which is, you know, the late 30s, early 40s, you know, it's a much smaller world than it was today. It's a subculture. And you know, it consists of, you know, a handful of fans in cities like New York or Los Angeles who can actually get together and start clubs and have meetings. But, you know, in some ways, those dynamics, they have not changed. All right. One thing that I was really struck by when I was doing my research for this book is that you look at, you know,
they were even like trolls in the 30s.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, the trolling, the flame wars, you know, the brigading. It's the exact same thing that you see today on Twitter or on Reddit, except that it unfolds in letters columns, that it unfolds in mimeograph fanzines. So these controversies, they kind of blow up and they take months to play out as opposed to a few hours online. But the behaviors and kind of the language and, you know, the way that you can have a community of outsiders that also starts to exclude others, you know, these things are there from almost day one. And so I actually found that I understood some of the more recent kind of manifestations of fan culture on a much deeper level after having thought about how they emerged in the 30s.
And to that point about people being excluded, this is largely the story of four white men. How do you think women and others played a role in this early culture?
Yeah, I mean, one of the high points for me of writing this book was to tell the stories of people like Donya Campbell, Campbell's first wife, who played a huge role in his career, you know, in some ways was his unofficial assistant editor. And
at what point they suggest during World War II she can take over the magazine?
This is a great story. Yeah. So what happens is that, and the other I should mention first that the other amazing figure in the story is Leslyn Heinlein, who was Heinlein's wife at the time, and again was his collaborator. I mean, I should also really mention that Heinlein probably Campbell's best writer, certainly the one that he thought of most highly, you know, and probably had the greatest influence on science fiction as it evolved. He and Leslin worked very closely on these stories, and they would pitch ideas back and forth and come up with the plots together. So she was a big part of his career. And you see this very clearly after Pearl Harbor, because Heinlein is an arch patriot. He's very eager to sign up. And Campbell is more reluctant. You know, he has two magazines he's running, and he's concerned that without him, they'll just kind of die out. And Heinlein has this amazing letter where he says, well, I think that Donia and Leslin could do as good a job or better than you of running the magazine. And that to me just you know, it never actually went anywhere, but you know, it just speaks volumes about the influence and the importance they had to their husbands' careers. But it is true that the slate of writers and fans during this period was not very diverse. You know, they were mostly white males, and you know, I'm very aware of this fact. And you know, it's a big part of the book, the question of diversity, because in some ways, Campbell, he bears part of the blame for limiting the range of voices that science fiction had for a long time, because he was, you know, he expressed some very racist opinions in the magazine. He did not see diversity as a priority. And it was a real loss, because this is an editor who thinks that science fiction is really about cultural change. And if you want to have a conversation about cultural change, it makes a lot of sense to try to bring in voices who have been affected by cultural change for real in ways that, you know, might not be expressed by, you know, the fairly homogenous group of writers that Campbell was using. So I think it's a big loss. And I think, you know, that's a huge part of the story.
There's a line that I think you write at the end of the book, that we're now living in a science fictional world. And I can't help think about a conversation I had earlier this year about Arthur C. Clarke and the 50th anniversary of 2001: A Space Odyssey being this year in 2018, which is kind of crazy to think. So Arthur C. Clarke is someone who follows the legacy. He's part of the legacy after these guys that we've been talking about. But I wonder how you think science fiction and these principles live on when we are seeing advances in real life that were predicted in fiction decades ago?
You know, it's a very interesting question, because I think there is sort of a good side and a bad side. I think Campbell's legacy as a writer or as an editor, you know, is very visible here. You know, he certainly worked with Clarke. Clarke is, you know, a writer that he discovered, although he wasn't as close to Clarke as he was to some of these other authors. But, you know, the notion that all problems can be solved through technology, or that all problems can be seen as subsets of engineering, is one that I think, you know, Campbell and his writers were largely responsible for. You know, and on the one hand, you see this in kind of the people they encouraged to enter careers in the sciences, you know, which is a big part of their legacy, and, you know, which is obviously great. But at the same time, you know, there are certain problems that probably can't be solved entirely through technology. One example is climate change. And I think about this a lot, because I think there's a sense that if we can figure out some kind of geoengineering solution, you know, or we can get someone like Elon Musk or a billionaire to kind of solve these problems for us, you know, that we don't have to deal with like the deeper social issues that they uncover. And I think that's a big liability. I think it actually can turn into an excuse to not seek out other kinds of change. And I think it's pretty clear that there are aspects of human life that can't be reduced to engineering. You know, one thing that we haven't really talked about so far is L. Ron Hubbard, who was, you know, one of Campbell's most popular
writers. I know
that's
a big part of the book that we didn't have a chance to get to. But even how the whole idea of Dianetics is introduced in the pages of this magazine.
Yeah, I mean, the very short version is that, you know, Hubbard's ideas were about reducing psychology to a kind of engineering. And, you know, Campbell loved that idea. You know, it was one that he returned to repeatedly. And in Hubbard's case, you know, the ultimate result was Scientology. And it comes directly out of the science fiction community of that time, and especially out of Campbell's interests. So it kind of goes both ways. You can have a genre that affects the future in very positive ways, you know, by encouraging people to enter the sciences, but it also, in some ways, tends to cover over or to kind of pass over the limitations of that kind of worldview. And I try to bring up both sides in this book.
Alec Nevila Lee's latest book is called Astounding: John W. Campbell, Isaac Asimov, Robert A. Heinlein, L. Ron Hubbard, and the Golden Age of Science Fiction. As we said, it's been out for a month or two, and he's got a couple events coming up in the new year, including at the Chicago Public Library. We'll tweet out Alec's information if you're interested in following him for more on that. Alec, thanks for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. This was great.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. All year long, our producers look for newsworthy and interesting stories and conversations from Illinois and beyond to bring to you. But what you might not realize is they're also somewhat experts at various things that might surprise you, things we really don't get to talk about on The 21st. So we thought we would spend the last few minutes of our last live show of 2018 to take advantage of these expertise. These are the names you hear in our credits, but more importantly, they are the people who do all the hard work that make The 21st a reality every day. Alan Montesilio, Libby Foster, and Robin Lynn are here with me now. I never get to say welcome to The 21st to you guys. Hey, welcome.
Hello, good morning.
Thanks, Nyla.
Hi, Nyla.
So, Alan, let's start with you. You are our senior producer. During the week, this week, you were busy working on stories like State Farm and Illinois cookbooks. But like Superman, by day, you work in a newsroom. And by night, you are a huge sports fan. So the rest of our team knows that you know everything about the NBA. Did you grow up going to a lot of basketball games?
No, quite the opposite, actually. I was born in the States. I promise I won't tell my entire life story on this segment. I was born in the U.S., but when I was five, I moved to Hong Kong. My dad got a job there. So quite the opposite. I didn't go to any of NBA games. But what I did have were a huge collection of VHS tapes with old highlights from like the 80s and 90s. So the other important thing to point out here is that there were some English language channels, but it's not like I had PBS or even, you know, Nickelodeon or Cartoon Network. So instead of all of that, you know, it's 5 and 6 year old me watching a VHS, you know, 45-minute tape about like Larry Bird's life or something like that.
So this explains a lot, Alan.
Yeah, or the 1985, you know, Los Angeles Lakers titled "Return to Glory," narrated by Dick Stockton from CBS. Like, I kind of just watched all of those very, you know, people who were playing before I was born, mid-'80s, early-'90s, and then of course I watched Michael Jordan. They were still, even though I was growing up in the '90s and I was overseas, there were still, you know, plenty of opportunities to watch Michael Jordan play, at least on TV. But I did not go to actually any NBA games because I didn't grow up in the States, even though I'm a U.S. citizen.
And you were a Chinese lit major in college. We already did our book recommendations, but do you have any for us right now? What are you going to be reading over the holidays?
Yes, that's a heck of a, yeah, from the NBA to Chinese lit, sure.
Expertise, isn't that public radio?
Random expertise, indeed. So I have a few. One of the more well-known ones that people might have heard about is called Invisible Planets. It's a collection of science fiction short stories collected by Ken Liu. I think they're really fascinating. They collect there's a collection of a lot of the more well-known Chinese fiction writers, but it's in English, and anyone, you know, anyone listening to this can read it. I think it's really fascinating. And, you know, I also just think that it's important to read. You know, it's easy to think about countries like China or even Russia as purely kind of political and economic adversaries, and that lens is important, but I think it's really important to hear from, you know, the writers and artists in those places and hear what they think about their own countries and their own countries, you know, in China's case, rapid development. So Invisible Planets by Ken Liu is excellent. One of my favorite books written in the 90s is called Red Sorghum by this guy named Mo Yan. He was the first Chinese citizen to win the Nobel Prize in literature. And I'm a sucker for novels about families that sort of take place over a multi-decade span of time. And so this book is about a family that farms sorghum for wine through the kind of tumultuous history of the 20th century. All the way from, you know, the Japanese invasion in the 30s to World War II to the Chinese Civil War that ends with the communists winning. And it's also, you know, if folks have read Gabriel Garcia Marquez or, you know, 100 Years of Solitude, Love in the Time of Cholera, there are kind of some parallels to that in terms of the way it's written. So that one's a bit of a heavier read, but I also that's one of my all-time favorites, too. And finally, if you want something really, really ambitious, one of the greatest Chinese novels, well-known, you know, throughout the field and in China, is called The Story of the Stone, translated by David Hawks. And that is the story, kind of a long, long story of the rise and fall of one particular Chinese family, the Jia family, and it has dozens of characters, and it's really a masterpiece. And so lots of different options out there. And, you know, we had our segment about books, but there are so many excellent translated works out there. Translators work so hard. It's so difficult to both remain faithful to the material in the original language while not losing what makes it, and sort of trying to bring that into something where the rules are totally different and what makes it beautiful is totally different, but they do such an incredible job. So that's a long way of answering that question, but I think that those three, Invisible Planets, Red Sorghum, Story of the Stone, all fantastic if you want to read something different.
That's our 21st senior producer, Alan Montesilio. In our last live conversation of the year, I am talking to all of the producers from the 21st, and we're talking about their expertise and giving you a chance to get to know them a little bit too. Robin Lynn is with us. We have two producers who are based in Chicago. Alan's with me here in Urbana. Robin Lynn is one of our Chicago-based producers. Robin Lynn and Libby Foster are joining us from our studios at Northwestern University in Evanston at the Medill School of Journalism. Robin, you produced conversations this week about the best books of the year and NPR's investigation into advanced black lung and how many coal miners are unfortunately contracting this disease. Robin, when you sign off at night, what do you do?
I think that's, Nyla, when my real producing begins. And I think if I'm really an expert at anything, it is to how many murders are happening in the English countryside. Did you know that rural England is just filled with dead bodies, Nyla?
I presume you're talking about the PBS dead body count.
PBS, Netflix, Amazon, Hulu. If there's an accent and a dead body and it's streaming, I have seen it.
So what is the British streaming service? Acorn.
Acorn, BritBox. So if you're looking to take a break from the news and from the stress of the holidays, I have some UK murder mysteries that I can recommend.
Okay, before we get to that, Robin, I have to just say that this confounds me. I am not someone who turns to murder mysteries to relax. I don't really, honestly, this may alienate a lot of people. Mysteries are not my genre. My genre of relaxation is romance or history, like romantic history, like, which is ridiculous, but that's what I like to relax to. As you know, Robin, I am a huge fan of Outlander.
I do know.
Why do you find this relaxing?
Well, usually the formula of these kind of series, and many of them are adaptations of books, which are also very good and very relaxing, often in an audiobook form, I would recommend them. But the murder happens right out of the gate. So you're not filled with suspense about when that's going to happen. You don't see the gory details of them. You are just waiting for the comforting resolve, knowing that the characters that you really love and invested your time in are going to come to the solution and that all will be well at the end.
So the good guys always win.
The good guys don't always win, but you know, often enough they do. And fans of Law and Order will experience the same thing. There is a formula. You trust these characters and you can fall asleep in the middle of the show knowing that when you wake up, all was well while you were sleeping and they figured it out.
What are your recommendations? What's your favorite thing you've watching or you have been watching or that you want to watch over the holidays?
Agatha Christie is really the epitome of this genre. The current BBC adaptations are really admirable. So they have great acting and they're very stylized, but they are too dark for my liking because I want Christie that is intended for lazy Sunday afternoons with tea and cookies. Miss Marple is lovely, so I would check out all of them. But the best of all Christie, I think, is Poirot. David Suchet as the Belgian detective. He did it for over 20 years, and it's streaming on BritBox and Acorn. And if you're lucky, sometimes your local PBS station.
We've got a little clip from this. Let's take a listen.
Come on, Poirot, admit it. You're only going so you can be fussed over by Lady Chatterton. You took this case on simply because of the way she buttered you up.
You think it is wrong, Hastings? To enjoy the compliments, or the buttering, as you say?
No, but do you have to show it quite so much?
Robin Lynn, do you just relax hearing that?
You know, even when I'm not well, you know, and I want just like a little saltines and ginger ale, I put on Poirot. It makes me feel better.
All right, that's Robin Lynn, one of our Chicago-based producers, the other one of which is Libby Foster, who's also with Robin in Evanston at our studios there. Libby's a U of I grad, an Oak Park native, who took us to the Field Museum this week. But Libby, I understand that your true talent lies outside of producing. How did you discover your lip-syncing talent?
In all honesty, I think it came out of the choir kid in me, but I was a fake choir kid. I would fake my way through most of our performances, not let out any real sound just because...
You would just mouth watermelon?
Well, no, you can't just mouth watermelon. You have to know the words, but you're not actually making any noise. And that is the key to a truly successful lip sync.
And what is that part of what you're going to be doing over the holidays, Libby? Lip sync battles?
You know, holiday music is prime territory for lip syncing. I'm thinking about Mariah Carey. I'm thinking about Ariana Grande. There are some truly classics that if you have no musical talent, you can lip sync your way through.
So I sing. I don't lip sync. I think this is very different, but I like to sing mostly by myself in the car. I don't like to sing as much when other people are around. This is unusual, I will admit.
I think that's what makes it so fun, is that it's not just singing. You can dress up, you can dance, you can spin around, you can do it with your friends or your family, and you're not actually singing, so you're not out of breath. You still look good. You still feel good.
So. Okay.
You can now, win a lot of money on TV.
I was
going
to say,
yeah.
You can perform with Chrissy Teigen.
Yeah, or you can be on RuPaul's Drag Race if that's more of your speed.
So as we think about the last few minutes of our last live show of the year, I want to ask all of you guys what your favorite segments were that you produced this year. Alan?
So I'm thinking about a couple of segments we did that were based in Southern Illinois and that were talking about local histories being taught in public schools there. And you know, we did a few of these. One of them was about the Trail of Tears and the fact that the Trail of Tears actually ran partially through Southern Illinois. Another was the history of the Underground Railroad in Southern Illinois. You know, we think about Illinois as, you know, the land of Lincoln, a free state. But that narrative was really complicated by the fact that southernmost Illinois, there was a lot of kidnapping and a lot of challenges facing free black men and women there. And I liked those segments because I think it's always important to think about history as not a sort of static set of facts that happened a long time ago. It's always being reinterpreted. We're always learning more about it. And in particular, I'm always interested in what local communities are doing to learn about these, about where they live and doing that themselves.
Libby, what about you? What were your favorite segments that you produced this year?
So one of my favorite segments was the America to Me documentary, which was actually about my high school. And not to date myself, but it was filmed a year after I graduated. So
this is Oak Park River Forest.
Yeah, Oak Park River Forest, which is just west of the city. And it was just really interesting to watch it and view it. I actually had one of the teachers who was featured in the documentary, and it really resonated with me just because some of the things that he was featured in the film saying were things that I had thought about as a student there and things that kind of made me uncomfortable. And as a white female, I have a certain perspective on my school that I think is a lot of different perspectives were presented in that film, people of color, that I could kind of see things through their point of view and see how the same building could be viewed so differently by who you were.
Yeah. Thanks for that, Libby. Robin, what about you?
I think the segments that I end up thinking the most about are the ones that end up coming up in my everyday conversations with people. I think back about them because they made me think about topics that are coming up in the news or in everyday life a little bit differently. And one that we actually just did last week is about climate change, which is often coming up in the news. But I was really surprised to hear some of the perspectives that young evangelicals are having about climate change. And I've actually already had multiple conversations with people in my own circle just pointing to how I think that, you know, they might be surprised to know how people in different political parties and within different religious groups are having changing views about climate change. And another story that I've pointed people to and a book that I would encourage people to read is Kim Brooks' Parenting in the Age of Fear. We're going to replay it in the next couple of weeks as we take a little holiday break. But it gave me a lot to think about in terms of how I parent my two young children and how I think a lot of people are choosing to parent, making choices based on fear of being judged rather than necessarily choosing to do the right thing.
That's Robin Lynn, one of our three 21st show producers we have been talking to. I've been talking to Libby Foster and Alan Montesilio as they just mentioned some of their highlights for the year. As Robin said, over the next 2 weeks, we are taking a little holiday break and we have put together our favorite episodes for the year that we're going to replay for you. So if you tune in for the next 2 weeks, we will be here. We will not be here live, but we will be back with you in 2019. But I would love to say happy holidays, not just to everybody listening, but to Alan, Libby, Robin. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nyla.
Thanks, Nyla.
That does it for us today. Our Twitter handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the hour with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. Our Facebook page, if you want to search for The 21st to like us, is another way to comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Vishesh Anand, Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.